Hey there, everybody. Welcome to episode 60 of the Book Exchange Podcast. We're turning 60 here, at least in terms of episodes on the Book Exchange Podcast. It's exciting to reach another zero in our little journey here, talking about books. Yeah, and that voice you hear right there is my co-host and co-founder. That would be John Lovell, my twin brother, joining us from Easton, Maryland. John, are you on?
I am on. We've done this now 60 times, which is really kind of amazing. So when we started it, we were just like, well, we'll see how this goes. You know, maybe we'll get to 5 or 10. And now we've gotten to 60. So once again, we thank everyone who's tuned into the show, who's listened to an episode, who shared it with friends, family, et cetera, et cetera. But good to be back for another round.
Yeah, that's right, John. Yeah, it is kind of hard to believe. It's only been like three and a half years. Not even 4 years yet, and we've managed to get in, you know, a good 20 episodes a year. You know, with our busy lives and busy families, we're both dads, and you know, taking care of a lot of people and have responsibilities. It's been really a boon to be able to come back here every couple of weeks or so and talk about our favorite subject, books and literature and reading and sometimes writing. It's awesome. So we're very happy to have our listeners from around the world on with us. Reach out to us at bookexchangetwins@gmail.com, exchange with an X. If you want to get in touch with the show, let us know what's on your mind, topics, books you want us to read, anything that's on your mind, let us know. So, like I said, this is episode 60, and we're excited, John. You've been, the chitter and chatter back and forth between you and I has been pretty prolific because we have thought a lot about this type of book that we're going to be talking about today over many, many decades. We've certainly read a ton of them, but we've never dedicated an episode to the art of the memoir. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to unpack the genre that we call the memoir and talk about exactly what that is, what it isn't, etc. And then share towards the end of the show, we'll share some of our, you know, I don't know if they're our favorite memoirs or essential memoirs, but there are three memoirs that we would recommend that other people read, and we'll get into why, and we'll talk maybe a little bit more about some other titles. But before we get into the regular show format, John, do you want to say anything else by way of introduction into this topic of the memoir today?
Yeah. Nice tee up, by the way. I think that was an excellent setup, so it's good to know that you're on your game this afternoon.
Brian.
Yeah, this was, yeah, as you and I talked about, I mentioned this, you know, I think in our last episode when we were sort of teasing this episode, the whole idea for this episode was sort of inspired by some comments that my son made. My son is a college student. One of my sons is a college student in Washington, D.C., but he made this comment a couple of years ago, and for whatever reason, he had been assigned to in one of his literature classes to read a couple personal memoirs. And there were two in particular that he read, and he intensely disliked the experience of reading these memoirs. And he kind of, like, we were sitting at dinner, and he, as I said last time, he kind of went on this sort of semi rant about how people don't need to write memoirs. Memoirs are kind of pointless. And, you know, it was a rant. It was kind of an off the cuff sort of thing based on his reaction to these two books. So I don't want to, that's certainly not our stance on the memoir in general. There obviously have been many, many excellent memoirs that have been written over the centuries, and we'll touch on at least a couple of them today. But I sort of understood what he meant as well. You know, it was an interesting sort of back and forth. These two memoirs that he happened to read were more contemporary. I'll just say what they were, you know, and some of our listeners probably love these books. One was called The Liar's Club by Mary Carr, which is a book I know you're familiar with, Jude. I don't know if you've ever read it, but you certainly know about it.
Yeah, no, I haven't read it.
Yeah, but it's very, very well-known memoir. Another one is a more recent one, but was very, very popular. It's called The Glass Castle. The name of the author is escaping me right now, but most people know it.
Is it Wells? Is it somebody Wells?
Yeah, Jeanette Walls or Wells.
Walls, yeah.
Walls, I think. Apologies to Ms. Walls. But And I guess, you know, the point he was sort of making is that, you know, I think he was sort of talking about a particular type of memoir, and we'll get into the types a little bit, I guess. But like, when someone has had like either a traumatic childhood or a traumatic experience, and then they're kind of opening up and up about it. And my son was sort of like, we don't all need to know about that. You know, that's like personal to your story. It's an amazing story, but it doesn't need to be disseminated to everybody, which you could debate, you know, whether that's actually true or not, because these memoirs have obviously struck a chord with many, many people. But anyway, that discussion got me thinking, you know, number one, we, like you said, we'd never done an episode on the memoir. Number two, it's one of the most popular genres of book around. You know, there's many, many people, and, you know, we've gotten feedback from some people who knew we were going to do this topic and, you know, who love them. And memoirs tend to be really, really widely talked about and shared, et cetera. So it just kind of struck me that you and I, as you said, have read many memoirs of one type of another, or another, you know, in our reading lives. So it just seemed like ripe for the picking, and it would be, make for a really interesting discussion just to talk about, you know, what is a memoir and what makes a good memoir and all of that. So that's my little addition to your setup.
Yeah. I mean, totally, you know, like I mean, I'll just say right out of the gate, and we'll get into it. I think it's obviously a very, very popular genre of book. You know, I think it has been for centuries. I tend to think personally that I don't even know if I'm going to say this right, John, but we're winging it here. Like, by and large, I think that the appetite for the memoir, both in terms of readers and in terms of business, like the industry, may sort of outrun the quality of memoirs in a way. Like, there are, you know, way more memoirs to me that, you know, I don't know if I would say, like, you know, shouldn't have been written or anything like that. That's kind of, I don't mean it that way, but I mean, like, you know, like, it's, I guess I'm saying it's a rare thing. It's a very popular genre. People seem to want it. They're hungry for it in the publishing industry because readers want it. They're hungry for it as terms of readers around the world. But it's very hard still, I think, in my opinion, to find like a really high quality one. And then what makes that high quality one? That's kind of the meat of the episode we're going to be doing right now. So,
yeah.
Okay. So, John, and by the way, it was funny to hear your thoughts as we were deciding to, you know, this was the right time to take this genre on, and you telling your story about your son and you know, yes, he's young. Like, he's still young now, but some of his reactions were funny. And, you know, in the way that a young person, he's my nephew and I'm biased, but he's a very smart kid. He's a very smart young man. And sometimes, you know, a youthful reaction like that will ask kind of those questions that sort of need to be asked, right? Or at least are worth asking, you know, when you don't, you know, you're not older and you don't have the hesitancy or the filters or what have you, you know? So he was asking some interesting questions, and we're going to kind of try to unpack them maybe for our own benefit and the benefit of our listeners.
Yeah. He was just sort of digging into, you know, why are we reading these? And like, without actually articulating it, like, what is the value in sharing your life story, which I think is a great segue question into the rest of the episode.
Yeah, totally. Like, you know, he was just asking why, and it makes sense, especially particularly with regard to this genre. So, with that, let's talk a little bit. I'm going to kick the ball over to you, John, in our standard format. We're going to have a quick discussion about what we're reading right now and what, you know, what we think about it really briefly. And then that'll segue. You go first because mine has to do with the topic, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, well, I'm ready. I'm dipping into our favorite publisher or press, Jude, that we bring up from time to time on this show, New York Review of Books. They publish, what they do is they publish kind of sort of forgotten, you know, classics or books that, you know, have a lot of merit, at least in their judgment, but have somehow sort of fallen out of popularity or maybe even literally went out of print. So they brought back a 1947 novel that's called Storm by a man named George R. Stewart, who was a very successful writer in his time, early to middle Well, I would say middle of the 20th century. George R. Stewart is really interesting, you know, writer from what little I've gleaned. He wrote a few Westerns. He wrote a book. He wrote Western type novels when he started out, but he was also a scholar, and he kind of became, you know, veered a little bit more almost towards science fiction, but with an eye towards our ecology and environment. So he wrote probably his most popular or well-known book is a book called Earth Abides, which I've never read. He also wrote a fascinating nonfiction book, which I have on my shelf but have not read, which is called, I think it's called Names on the Land, and it's all about how places in America got their names. So it's like, which is a fascinating, I'm sure that's a fascinating book, and kind of digs into, you know, different cultures that have existed in North America and how we got some of our names, whether it's, you know, the Mississippi River or, you know, what North and South Dakota or whatever, you know. So that's pretty interesting. But his 1947 novel Storm, which is what I'm reading now, is just a fascinating idea. It sounds like it's a very pioneering novel in its way, because it's kind of one of the earliest examples of what we would now call an eco-fiction or an eco-thriller even. Mm-hmm. And he had the very interesting idea of writing a book in which the protagonist of the book is a weather system. So, which is a fascinating idea right out of the gate, right? You as a novelist and writer, you know, can you imagine taking on something like that?
No.
I mean, just an incredible idea. And so that led him to he did like several years of research on like, you know, meteorology and weather. And I mean, so far I'm about halfway through the book. So he just follows, he traces one weather system and he traces it almost as a person. As a matter of fact, just as a fascinating side note, you know, he gives the storm a name, and he calls it Mariah, and not Maria like our sister, but he makes a point to say, no, the pronunciation is Mariah. But he named the storm, right, which is something that nowadays is, you know, we're very used to, because every kind of major tropical storm or hurricane gets a name, right?
Right.
Well, that practice was inspired by this novel. So,
oh, wow.
Which is really interesting. So he had this idea that I'm going to follow this storm and sort of treat it almost as like a human entity. Obviously it's not human, but like I'm going to trace it from birth through adolescence, through maturity, through old age, and then death. And so that's what he's doing in the book. But the other fascinating thing about this novel that I think this novel would intrigue you for a lot of reasons, Jude, but, is that, so the storm is a protagonist, and then it's written in this style where you just have short passages, and he's just exploring how the storm affects all kinds of different people across North America and other parts of the world too, like Mexico. But this is a storm system that starts out near Japan and kind of comes across the Pacific Ocean and ends up slamming into California and Mexico. But along the way, so he sort of, you know, it's kind of hard to describe. It's very cinematic in a way. He just has these vignettes where you know, there's a guy who's driving a friend of his from Reno to California, and he starts off on his road trip, and it's just some guy, a worker, who meets a girl at a dance, and they're going to travel to California. And you eventually realize that each of these characters is going to be impacted by the storm one way or another. And so he's got, you know, meteorologist characters who are working in the like weather center and tracking the storm. He's got line workers who work for the power company. He's got ship captain and ship crewmen who are out on the ocean, or he'll talk about a housewife who's in Nevada, or he'll talk about, you know, all these different people who are eventually going to be impacted by this weather system, and their lives are going to be affected or changed in some way. And that's the whole book, but it's just this really fascinating, innovative narrative about the life of this storm system. And like I said, I'm about halfway through it, but so far it's fascinating. There's a lot of reading about weather, so that could get tedious to some people. It's not to me, but you know, if you don't find that interesting, then there's a lot of writing about wind and rain and clouds and stuff. But man, I mean, I don't think anybody had ever attempted anything like it. So you have to give George Stewart a lot of credit just for that. But it's just, I'm so glad that New York Review of Books, you know, exists, that they can bring novels like this back into print. So I'm about halfway through, you know, but I'm really enjoying the experience because it's just so different than most novels that you read.
Yeah. All hail NYRB, man. New York Review Press.
Yeah.
They put out some really interesting stuff. And isn't so you said that book's around like mid-century, 20th yeah. century?
Yep. Right after World War II, it was published.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah,
that's another... Sorry to interrupt, but that's another interesting little bit of trivia I learned. The reason that we refer to storm systems and air system as fronts is because the terminology and the science of meteorology was just kind of, you know, maturing and blossoming in the years after World War I. So, like, we talk about the Eastern Front or the Western Front. In a military sense, they started calling these cloud formations fronts. And so that terminology, which again is so common to us today, is only because, you know, that science was kind of coming of age, so to speak, right after World War I. I thought that was really interesting.
That is very interesting, yeah. Like what they call it before then, even when they, you know, if the discipline or if the field of meteorology wasn't around yet, they would still probably call it something like a cloud wall or something like that, you know.
Yeah, it's just kind of a wild trivia, but go ahead. You probably forget what you were saying, but
well, no, I was just saying I remember. Isn't there a, I think you know, just from being at your house, I think you have another NYRB put out another book. I think it's like really a really big book, and it might be nonfiction, but isn't there some kind of volume also published by NYRB, which is like a history of the wind?
Or the yes, wind. Yes.
You know, like, but that's not, if I remember right, that's not a fictional endeavor?
No, it's a nonfiction book. It's written by a British, can't remember the name, but a British scientist. But, I mean, it's hard to imagine. And the thing's like 500 or 600 pages, so I don't even, these are, to your point, I think you're bringing up, it's like you can't even imagine how somebody takes on writing something like that.
Yeah, it's just, you know, that speaks to the adventurous, you know, prospecting from NYRB, but also just, you know, it's just a fascinating comparison. But anyway, yeah, you know, you and I have discussed that book Storm here and there over the last 5, 6, 7 years, and it's kind of cool that you're reading it now. That's like, I probably would really enjoy that. So I'm sure it's very interesting.
Yes, sir. So now it's your turn.
Yep. And that's going to be my segue into the topic of memoirs, because what I decided to do, which is something I often do, John, you weren't surprised to hear this. You know, like one of the things we talked about early on when we were game planning to talk about memoirs is how maybe even more so than most other genres, you know, like this is really a bottomless pit. This genre, like there's so many of them from so many countries over so many centuries, and you know, it's like, you know, in theory anybody could write one, right? You know, like as everybody right. has a life. So, but I thought, well, you know, I certainly hear about memoirs from time to time, and every once in a while there's one or two or three or four titles that are like kind of almost the flavor of the month or like the really buzzy memoir. Glass Castle from a few years back is one of them. The Liars Club from even more years back is another one. And you know, there was one that called Heavy by this, I think an African-American writer named, I think it's Kason Lehman, if I might not be getting that right, but
yeah,
Heavy was a very popular memoir, 2 or 3 years ago. My daughter was assigned that when she was in college, and she, you know, she kind of did a little short, smaller version of what Nathan did, kind of lamenting having to read this memoir, Heavy, which I haven't read, and I know a lot of people like. So I decided to go out and find one of the memoirs that I had been hearing about most recently. There was one that was called Crying in H Mart. That's written by a young woman. I don't remember her name, but she's also a musician. You might know her. Do you know her name, Crying in H Mart?
I think her name is Michelle. Is it Zauner? Like Z-A-U-N-E-R, something like that.
Okay, yeah.
But she...
No, I have no idea.
She's a popular indie musician as well.
Yeah. Now, that was just a title I had heard of. I have no idea what that memoir is about. But then another title that I heard of is the one I chose. I found it in the library. And the book is called Stay True, and it's written by, I looked this up, I hope I'm getting this right, Hua Xu, H-U-A-H-S-U, who is the son of Taiwanese immigrants. But I just heard about his book, and I had seen the cover of it, which is a picture of a young Asian man behind an old 35-millimeter camera taking a picture of the person taking a picture. Didn't know anything about it, but then I found out only after I borrowed it from the library that this book recently is the inaugural recipient of the brand new Pulitzer Prize for Memoir that was just started this last year. They normally forget what all the categories are, but there's a Pulitzer Prize. Well, there's Pulitzer Prizes for journalism and all that stuff. But
biography.
I know there's one for biography. You're right. I know there's one for fiction. I know there's one for poetry. Not sure of the others, but they just initiated one for memoir. And this book, Stay True, is the first one that was received the Pulitzer Prize for memoir. So that's all I knew about it. Turns out to be the story of this young man, Hua Xu, who, young at least by our standards, I think he's about maybe 10 years or so younger than we are, John, maybe somewhere in that range. He is, like I said, the son of Taiwanese immigrants. He grew up in the Bay Area, and it is the story of his kind of coming of age and going to Berkeley in the Bay Area in California, developing friendships with a bunch of different people from diverse cultures. He makes friends with a young Asian man who's from Japanese lineage, whose grandparents were in the camps in the United States. They kind of clash in their definition of what it means to be an Asian American. And the description of the book says that the two of them become friends, even though the other fellow, whose name is Ken, kind of represents everything that Hua Xu does not want to be as an Asian American. Nonetheless, they become friends. And then after only a couple of years, Ken is unfortunately murdered in a random act of violence, like a carjacking.
Wow.
And so the memoir is about his friendship with this young man, Ken, and his kind of writing, because he turns into a writer, and his writing his way through this experience and trying to find some meaning in it by working on this memoir for many years. So that's what the book is about. I kind of had some issues with it almost right away, but maybe I'll save that for the general discussion we're going to have here in a minute. Anyway, that's the book I'm sort of finishing up now. So I'll take a pause. Is there anything else you want to say kind of in terms of, you know, what we're reading or introduction, or do you want to just dive right into the discussion?
I think we can pretty much dive in. I'll just say you touched on this in the beginning. I think, you know, a lot of times we do these shows, we just kind of run through a list of choices that we've each made. I think this time we're going to have more of a little bit of a free-form discussion first. And then, like you said, I think we're each going to pick out, you know, a couple of our favorites. And then at the end, I don't think you mentioned this at the end, I also wanted to highlight, when I was just researching this, I realized there's so many both older and contemporary memoirs that I would love to read. So I was going to just highlight a few that I really want to read that are kind of on my wish list. And that's just kind of an excuse to cover more titles, really. But so that's kind of how we're going to approach it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was interesting that you brought that up. This is just one place where you and I were thinking a little bit differently, because I really don't have a list like that. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of memoirs I'd be willing to read, but I don't have kind of like a working list of memoirs that I just feel like I really should have gotten to. So I'm not really going to do that, but it's going to be interesting to hear what you have to say in terms of what you want to read. And one of them that you brought up to me off camera, I was like, oh yeah, sign me up for that. So
yeah,
that'll be kind of fun. But yeah, let's dive in. We're going to go for like another half an hour, 35 minutes or so, just talking about the genre in general. And then we'll take a break and get to some of our, you know, like our favorite memoirs or some memoirs that really stood out to us. So that's the way we're going to roll with it. Now, John, I thought just to kind of get into it, I have to say, I kind of learned a lot from preparing for this episode in terms of what I think about this genre and, you know, what I like and don't like. And I don't know if I ever gave it that kind of thought before. Usually it's just I'm trying to diversify my reading and there's one that I heard about or that I, you know, if it's a literary memoir, I'm like all over it just because I like to write books. You know, but I don't give a lot of thought to the kind of the form in general too often. And once I started doing that, I made some kind of revelations. And at this point, I would say I got to thank there's a really good friend of the show who wrote to us, who emailed to us. And when she found out that we were going to cover the topic of memoir, she wrote to us and said, I'm really excited. This is my favorite genre of books. And I was like kind of astounded because I don't know if I've ever met anybody who said that their memoir was their favorite genre. Although there are probably tons of people who would say that, but I haven't heard a lot of people say that before.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really interested to know why, both from her perspective and from my own thought process, if it's not my favorite genre, which is definitely not, why not? And I started, and then she sent us a list of some of her favorites. There was like kind of a long list of memoirs that in almost every case I had heard of, but I had never read before. Most of them, I want to say, were by women. Maybe not most, but over half. And I realized when I was going through my reading that I haven't read a ton of memoirs by women. Again, hasn't really been intentional. I guess you just gravitate towards figures that interest you or whatever. But I could certainly use reading more memoirs written by women. But so where I'm going with this is she said this is her favorite genre. I sort of realized, John, in preparing for this episode, that's definitely not my favorite genre. I can talk a little bit about why, but I want to ask you, basically, what is your relationship to the memoir? Like, where do you characterize how you fall down on this particular genre in general? And, like, has it changed over the years? Or, like, in a broad way, like, what do you think about this genre?
Well, I mean, that is the subject at hand, isn't it? Well, yeah, I have thoughts. I try to corral them and make some sense of them. You know, I don't know that I would necessarily call it my favorite genre either, but you're right in that, you know, when I started thinking about it intentionally for this show, I realized, you know, A, I've read quite a few of them, so there must be something there. And B, you know, just like you, I hadn't really given it a ton of thought before. You know, if I take a step back and say, you know, what is a memoir as opposed to like, you know, it's a little bit different than like an autobiography where you tell your entire life story, or, you know, there's all kinds of, or like a book of investigative journalism, for example, or reportage where you like look into a specific topic and describe your experience. You know, memoirs typically are looking back at an experience that the author had. Often, you know, when they were young, but not always, but mm-hmm. some kind of like experience that really shaped who they were. And they're sharing that experience. And when you think about that, you think, well, and this sort of gets to the heart of what I think Nathan was touching on. Nathan, my son, I understand that, and I understand what he was trying to say. It's like, you know, if you had a personal traumatic experience, it doesn't have to be traumatic, but often it is. But if you had some kind of personal experience, you know, I can see how that would be really formative for you, you know. But does that necessarily mean it would be formative in the sense of like, you know, it obviously shaped who you were, but going through that experience has some kind of instructional value, you know, something to say or to teach, right? So you can see how some of these experiences, like let's take a book like The Glass Castle, you know, the way that that woman was raised, you could see how that would be, you know, make a huge impact on her. But the best memoirs kind of take that kind of experience that they're describing and allow readers to kind of like enter into that experience in order to, you know, they're not intended to teach really, but in order to, you know, give them, think about their own lives or think about these experiences and how they might have shaped this person and what that might mean. And eventually what it comes around to is like a memoir is a really, is an exceptional way to kind of teach people empathy, you know, to that whole idea of like walking in another person's shoes and realize that some people have lived through some pretty incredible experiences. And, you know, in doing that, you know, when you think about that, think about what that must have been like, you know, it in turn causes you to sort of think about your own life. I'm not sure I'm saying that clearly, but you know, I kind of, the more I thought about what the best memoirs do is that they kind of help you to think about experiences that maybe we all share, you know, or struggles we all share, and kind of grow from that through like empathizing with that particular person. So I would say that my understanding of you know, what a memoir is and how valuable it is has changed over time. And for me, you know, just because of my personal inclinations and, you know, from when I was a young man, even to now, I've always been interested in the spiritual side of life. So a lot of my memoir reading, at least initially, were spiritual memoirs, which can be stories of like conversion or stories of people who have had their faith tested and how they've come through that, et cetera. So like, you know, when I was a younger man, especially, I read a lot of those types of books, like C.S. Lewis's Surprised by Joy would be an example, which is an account of his conversion to Christianity. So that was just my kind of personal inclination. But as I've gotten older, I would say my interests have sort of expanded out, and I've just in general. And so now, you know, there's all kinds of memoirs that seem interesting to me because they just open up a window into another type of life that's very different from my own. And that holds plenty of fascination for curious readers. So I don't know. I was bouncing around a lot there, but I hope I said some things that kind of like sort of answer your question.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, as I've done many times, I kind of tossed you a big question, sort of an open-ended one. You know, and you can kind of take it where you're going to take it. It's just to get the wheels rolling, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's the one thing that was that this listener to the show, this friend of ours, said. And I wish, you know, I'm not going to say it the way she said it. She said it in a nice way in an email. But she was, like, one of her most salient points to me was that the memoir is kind of a master class. I'm paraphrasing. I'm not using her words. And in empathy. And for her, it was particularly meaningful, I guess, that it was teaching you, these books teach you to walk a mile in another person's shoes, but it's a real person as opposed to a made up person.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I thought that was very interesting because for me, it's definitely more interesting experience in general, a more engaging thing for me to put myself in the shoes of a fictional character that seems very real, but has a totally different kind of existence than I do, you know? And I was like, well, why don't I, you know, respond as well to the memoirs? Like sort of the big takeaway for me, John, with prepping for this episode was that I was like, memoir is not my favorite genre. I don't read as many as I thought. And I had trouble kind of coming up with ones that were really essentials for me. And I don't know what this says about me. The ones that I did come up with are not spiritual memoirs. I had very few spiritual memoirs on my list, although I like reading them, just like yours. And, you know, if there was going to be one, it would be The Seven Story Mountain by Thomas Merton, but I thought that that was more of a autobiography.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. And you started to talk about the difference between the memoir and the autobiography. I think you covered it pretty well. You know, all I was going to say was, you know, add to that, which you sort of implied anyway, but that the memoir to me seems to cover a limited period of time versus like the full story up to a certain point, you know?
Yeah, and there's also, I'm sorry if you're getting an echo. I'm hearing an echo, but we'll just ignore it. But
yeah, I don't hear it, but go on.
There's also, you know, some intentionality, I think, behind sharing whatever that experience is, whether it was something from your childhood, whether it was overcoming a disease, whether it was a hard marriage, whatever. It's like you're sharing it to the author, I think, is kind of like looking back at it, trying to discern and glean what possibly they learned from it, and then with intentionally sharing it because they believe that it taps into or it has something to say to other human lives. You know, I think that's sort of an essential part of a memoir. There's a reason that they're sharing it. Now, you can debate whether they should be sharing it or whether it's worth sharing, but to the writer, they feel that it's worth sharing because it has some value. It may spur thought or questions or, you know, have some value to other people, you know, to readers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think the kernel in there from your comments about, to me, what really sets apart, this is just my opinion, like a really high quality memoir from the just endless stacks and mountains of memoirs that, you know, may be well-written books but are not really essential to me, is the ability to draw that bridge between whatever story you're telling from your life and the story and everybody else's story, you know. And as I was going through the list, I found very few books in my list that really seemed to do that well to me. And that got me to thinking about something I want to bring up now just briefly about the level of difficulty, I guess, with this particular genre and, you know, how it may seem like an easy thing to do to write a memoir because everybody has a life and it's just a matter of how you, you know, talk about it and explain it and apply it to everybody else, you know, or, you know, try to share the story with everyone else. But you know, we've talked and I talked to you before the show, but this podcast that we have is about books, obviously, books and reading and writing. And, you know, one of us doesn't write books, but one of us does. And I do write books and I've been writing books for the last 30 years. And I've written nonfiction books as well as fiction books. And I realized, you know, I think I knew this. Well, I know I knew this, but this helped me to look at this a little differently. Like, I've actually tried to write 3 or 4 memoirs that didn't happen, that fizzled out in some way. And I realized that kind of like what, you know, I started to think about the memoirs that I've kind of dug into and wrote half of or a quarter of or something like that and abandoned because it was too hard or for some reason I was unable to tell the story. Like, for example, for maybe most of a year, I was trying to write a memoir about my spiritual life. I had one of my all-time favorite titles for it, John. I'm hanging on to this title with all 4 of my feet and hands because I love this title that I got from him. It was called The Feast of Heaven and Earth, which I had all kinds of ways to connect to my own story. So I was really excited about the title of this potential memoir. But I got very far into this book, like maybe about halfway, and I had an impetus for writing it, and I was writing it for my children to try to describe my Catholic upbringing and what that was like and why it was meaningful to me. And then I just hit a brick wall and I just essentially said, nobody is going to care about this. You know, I don't know how to make this a book that people will care about. And then at an earlier point,
well, I'm sure your children would.
I'm sure they would. I hope they would. I was looking back over some of it. I really liked a lot of the writing in it. I had shared with a lot of people that I was writing it, but I really lost something essential. And it was not the first time, is my point.
Mm-hmm.
And 4 or 5 years earlier, for some reason, right after you and I lost our dad, doesn't really have much to do with this, I decided I was going to write a memoir about what it was like to have an identical twin brother. And I got probably about 30 or 40,000 words into that manuscript. And I had a good title for that one, too. It was called My Second Dimension, which you would recognize.
Yeah.
It's like a play off a punk song that my little brother had written. Anyway. I was really proud of that work. I still have that manuscript, and I was writing about it, and then the same thing happened. I got to one point, and I just kind of got lost in this quicksand, and I was like, who's going to give a shit, pardon my French listeners, about this story? I'm not selling this, you know, in a way that's interesting. Couldn't get past it. So, and then actually the first book I ever wrote in book form was a memoir. It was called Mech Soldier. Mech was short for mechanized infantry because I was a soldier in the infantry.
I remember that.
Yeah, thank you. That's in the hall of infamy. But I later was able to convert that into what I think is a successful first novel that I'm proud of. It's called Blue Six, by the way. Go check it out. But but my point is, though, and I'll stop there with my own writing, but like I really struggled to write memoirs myself, and I could not make a successful connection, at least in my mind, and I was a guy that was writing the books, between my story and the rest of the world. And then that got me just to thinking about why, when we talk about kind of our essential ones, those books on my list at least were successful in making that connection. So, you know, I'll turn it over to you. I don't even know if this is leading to a question or anything like that, but, you know. It's like, I don't want to knock the whole genre. I had issues with this book, Stay True, that I'm reading, and with lots of other memoirs that I've read. I can talk about those. But it's not an easy thing to do, and I agree very much with your point, just to transition to you, that the best ones seem to find this rather subtle, John, a clever, kind of ingenious way of connecting it to everyone else on the planet, you know? And so, I don't know, where do you want to take that thought?
Well, I don't know if it was Sherlock Holmes who said this phrase first or what, but, you know, therein lies the rub because,
yeah, right.
You know, Nathan's comments, and you think about some, it's really interesting because you think about Nathan's comments, the anecdotes you just shared about how you were writing this thing and then you got to a point and you said, you had that sneaking thought, like, who is going to care about this other than me? And for you, that became... It just knocked one of the wheels, or let me use a different analogy. It just took the air out of the sails. And as you said, you need to have that air in your sails to keep going. You know, you're writing a book right now. You're telling me how, like, the winds are blowing, and you're just going with it because it's taken on a life of its own. And that's how you know. But for whatever reason, that thought took the wind out of your sails. I think Nathan was sort of like, we need more people to have that thought. You know, when they're... Yeah. When they're sharing their life story. Now, am I saying I agree with Nathan? You know, in general, or as it comes to those two books that he referenced, The Liar's Club and The Glass Castle. In general, maybe. And we'll talk about, I think there is like a real glut of memoirs this year that are fed by celebrity culture. And, you know, the kind of the way our culture is now. Our culture in general is a pretty narcissistic culture and kind of a voyeuristic culture too. So this all feeds into, you know, the glut of memoirs that we have, like the celebrity memoir, the fam memoir, whatever you want to call it. Right. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Kind of lost the thread of my own comment here, but, well, the rub is, you know, that question, like, is this experience that I had or I am having that is very meaningful to me, what makes it worth sharing or what makes it, you know, worth putting out into the world so that other people can, you know, glean something from it through, something from it too? Do I have the answer to that question? Of course I don't. But, you know, many people read books like The Glass Castle, read books like The Liar's Club, or Educated, that book that came out a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. written by a young woman. And it was about, she was raised by, like, you know, kind of like, I don't know what you call them, like sort of freedom fighter types in like Idaho and in a very kind of sheltered existence. I haven't read this book, so I'm just going from what I know. I'm interested to read it, but, and she, you know, was sort of raised in a very specific way. And the memoir is about how she kind of like came to realize there's a world outside of the one she was being raised in and actually, you know,
she's being homeschooled and just a very sheltered existence. She ended up, you know, kind of like working her way to like Harvard, I think, and Oxford, and you ended up getting this really high level education. And that's what that book is about. You know, obviously all books like this really have struck a chord with many, many people, you know, so you do have to quit, you know, you may read something like, I read The Glass Castle and I felt a little bit like Nathan. I felt like you feel a certain sense of fascination that this child was raised this way by this crazy mother and had all these just insane experiences. And there's a certain level of fascination, like how did she ever survive this? And that's what the book is about. But then it's also like, I don't know, I felt personally like a little bit like a voyeur, like kind of saying, you know, I'm standing off going, why aren't those people crazy? Man, I'm glad she got out of that situation. But then where is the value outside of that? You know, I don't know. That's something that we can debate. But I think what the best memoirs do, and I'm not saying that The Glass Castle or any of those books isn't among that group, but what they do is they tap into experiences that are universal in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And they just, that makes it relatable. Like whether it's like there are all kinds of different memoirs, but some of them are about like working through a disease, surviving a disease. And so they make you think about questions of your own mortality. Well, everybody asks those questions, you know, and everybody can kind of step into, like the listener was saying, step into the shoes of that person who's going through this agonizing ordeal and think to themselves, like, how would I handle a situation like that, you know? And so there's value from in some memoirs of being able to allow you to do that, you know. Then the last thing I would say, Jude, and just on a kind of practical level, I think, you know, the best memoirs are written very well too, you know.
Yeah.
Like I read one, which I'm going to talk about a little later. I read one recently that has been sort of a recent bestseller. And one of the reasons I was really struck by the book is it was beautifully expressed. It happens to be a book about somebody who was dying, but the way this person expressed their questions and their struggles, I mean, was beautiful. It just drew you right into his story just because of the way he was able to express it. So you know, you may have a really interesting story to tell, but I think the best memoirs are also, they become, you know, as shared and as talked about as they are because of the way they're expressed, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot to unpack there, but it's like, you know, you're right. There are some memoirists who you read their famous memoir or whatever, and it's almost like one type of memoir. You read it and you say, well, you know, it's because of the way this person writes. I mean, if this person wanted to write their next book about painting the wall in their bedroom, I'm in, you know, just because of the way that they write. Other books are just, you know, sort of tales relating. They're kind of serviceably written, which is how I would describe Hua Xu's book, although I think it's kind of reaching for beauty in different places, but I think it's kind of serviceably written. It's not like blowing me away on like a sentence by sentence or a prose level, but they're telling some kind of story that they think is, like we've been saying, like kind of a certain segment of their experience that, you know, had some extraordinary lessons or what have you. But, you know, what I wanted to say is, and with regard to this book, this recent memoir, but just memoir in general, is, you know, it's implied in all the discussion we've had so far, but what is very characteristic of a lot of memoirs, maybe not all of them, but most memoirs, is some kind of trauma or difficulty or challenge that a person has overcome. And that in itself is a very fraught environment to be kind of playing in, very fraught sandbox to be playing in, to use a tired metaphor, because there's such a thin border between telling about this difficulty you went through and whining about this difficulty you went through. And then a lot of times, you know, that's where like the publishing gets involved and like, you know, the way they sell the memoir. Like I'll give you an example. Like I had not even started Stay True yet, and I already knew it won the Pulitzer Prize, but I was reading the marketing copy And it, you know, it's telling the story, and it says this young man, Ken, he's the guy who ended up getting killed, sort of represents all that Hua Shu defines himself in opposition to. The only thing Hua and Ken have in common is that however they engage with it, American culture just doesn't seem to have a place for either one of them. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, I know I'm a white man, and I'm not an Asian American, and I'm not trying to dismiss any of, there's actually a lot of very interesting insights in this book about the Asian American experience that I didn't know. But Hua Shu is a Pulitzer Prize winner now, and he writes for the New Yorker. So to say that he has, that our culture has no place for him, to me, is kind of like ridiculous.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
you know, but I think he's talking about his past and like the way that things have historically been for Asian Americans in this country. And I kind of get it, but it puts sort of, I have to admit, it sort of sets me on edge. I'm like, well, you're doing fine, man. Like you just, like you got your book published and you won the Pulitzer first time out and you write for the New Yorker. So good for you. Like our culture seems to have a place for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but then, and then it goes on at the end of the copy, John, it says this, and you brought this up a moment ago and I love it because it's exactly what I was going to say. It says, this is what the copy says, John. A coming-of-age story that details both the ordinary and extraordinary. Stay True is a bracing memoir about growing up and moving through the world in search of meaning and belonging, which applies to every single person on this fucking planet. Pardon my friend. You know, like, I'm sorry for the cursing, but sometimes we do it for emphasis. So, and I, you know, I relate to that, but everybody relates to that. And I'm so far, I don't really see what, I'm sorry, Mr. Shu, but like what Hua Shu's, I mean, he did overcome this tragedy. I'm not, the tragedy about his friend is very tragic. And it's, and he does write movingly about his friend, you know, so I'm not knocking on that. It's just that I don't know that there's anything in this book, and then I'll go past it, that, you know, is that much different from kind of what we all have to handle, you know, and that's sort of the rub.
Well, and you and I talked about this because there is a glut now of, like, you know, especially if any person who's well known, and I think, again, I'll say again, I think it has to do with the way our culture is now with social media and the way everybody is connected to everyone else. Everybody watches what everyone else does, either through their own videos or a video someone else is taking on the side. We're all sort of laughing at each other through social media. Like, everything is public. And so it creates this sense of, like, this kind of culture of, like I said, voyeurism on the one hand and oversharing on the other. So, you know, it's like, and I'm a victim of it too. Like, I do it. I'll post, say, hey, you know, I was at a football game today. And it's like, again, you could ask what you asked before. That's great, but does it need to be published? Probably not. You know, right. Like, but anyway, and so anybody who has a public face, it feels like, what I'm trying to say is I think there is a lot of value in the genre of the memoir and the art of the memoir, to go back to the title of this episode. I think there is a ton of value in that when it's done well. It has a lot for readers and for human beings to share. But we also have this culture where if you're famous, you need to write one just because you're famous, and your audience will lap it up. So, like, and there isn't always a reason for it. Like there, I told you off air, you know, there was a reporter for like CNN or something, and she had the very traumatic experience of in her life. This is, I hope you're sitting down. She, you know, went through the agonizing process of helping one of her young teenagers decide where he or she is going to go to college. And then they actually moved into the college and, you know, he or she started there. So can you imagine? I mean, that just a tremendously, I don't know how she ever survived that trauma, but fortunately she wrote a whole book about it. And Now, so we can all, you know, kind of relive that and kind of grow through her experience of moving one of her children, helping her children decide where to go to school and moving them into school. I mean, do we need a memoir about that? There are millions and millions of parents. A, there are millions of parents who are doing that every year with their own kids. B, not every kid gets to go to college. So let's keep that in mind. But it's like, That's the substance of that memoir. If that's what we're the memoir's about, we don't need it. I'm sorry, but we don't need it. But it's because the person has an audience and is well known and is a celebrity. Or like I told you about an actor who wrote a memoir about the trip he and his son took to walk the Camino, El Camino in Spain. I'm sure it was a very powerful experience. And fans of that, you know, actor would probably enjoy it because they get to like walk along with him and his son. I get that, you know, it may be a nice diversion, but at the same time, thousands and thousands and thousands of regular people do that. I'm not sure we're gonna get a whole lot of out of a memoir where he just describes his trip with his son. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, I think there is great value, and we're gonna bring up some examples, you know, not just in this age, but across time where writers have shared their experience, and it can be very enriching for the reader, just for their mental life, sometimes for their spiritual life, and just kind of like as instruction and empathy or whatever. But we got to be, I think everybody needs to ask a question like you did, like, is there value in sharing this story? I don't know who's definitively going to answer that question, but you know, you almost wish that it was asked more, especially with these celebrity memoirs. It's like, you know, just because you have a TV show or starred in a few movies doesn't mean we all need to hear part of your life story. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I'll just, I'm going to segue into a break, John. I like some of the things you were saying there, but I'm just going to share kind of one other example from me. Something you and I were talking about before we did this episode, just another example of maybe books that aren't needed. I was telling you about this teacher I had when I was in graduate school at the New School in New York, and she was a fiction workshop teacher, and she had written three novels. But at the time that I had a fiction workshop with her, and I liked her a lot, I had read, I think, two of her books. I liked them. I didn't think they were like incredible, but I liked them, and she was very kind to me and compassionate. She was pregnant at the time, and now that kid is like 30 years old. You know, like, it's kind of weird. But anyway, she was just about, I didn't know this at the time, but she was just transitioning her writing career from being a novelist to being primarily a memoirist. And the way she did that was, this woman was very beautiful. Like, she had like natural beauty, you know. She was a white blonde haired woman. And she had published in Vanity Fair because she was like a novelist, you know, somebody who's in the New York scene, this article about the great pitfalls and how little people know how tough it is to be as beautiful as she was, you know. and it really created kind of a little mini flap because people were like, oh, come on, you know, like, but, you know, woe is you, you know?
Yeah.
And she went from there to publishing a memoir that was not on that subject, but it was a memoir about how when she was a young woman, like in her 20s, she was struggling through her college career at like Sarah Lawrence or some uppity college in like the New York State or something like that. Also just like conducting a wild affair on the side with a married man in his like mid-50s and kind of struggling through all that experience and, you know, dealing with all that, which I'm sure was very confusing. But it, you know, like, it doesn't sound that traumatic, you know, to a certain point of view. And then she gets a call in the middle of the night that her two elderly parents were in a car accident and they were both like seriously injured. So she had to move back home and take care of her elderly parents. And that was the memoir. And then, so, you know, tough life experience, kind of a weird way into the memoir genre, but she went from there to publish like four or five other memoirs about, you know, how they had to go through like COVID and she got married and, you know, they had to move from the city into the affluent white suburbs and how tough that was on her and her son, you know, at the private school that he went, you know, and it was like a whole bunch of series of memoirs based on that life. I don't wish to be really snarky or nasty, but it would, you know, and I didn't read most of these books, so I'm not saying it's just like, you know, I guess there's such a, you know, there's that line again between how valuable it is to tell kind of every story that happens to you. And sometimes maybe you can't even see around your own privilege or, you know, how good you have it kind of thing. So anyway, That's another example. I don't want to say the woman's name or anything like that, but yeah, why don't we do this? Why don't we take a quick break? And then when we come back, why don't we talk about some of those books that for you and me did what you were saying before, like managed in some way, either through their craft, like the beauty of the actual workmanship in the book, or through the way that they, you know, the uncanny or very unusual nature of the experience that's being related. Let's talk about some examples of memoirs that really made a difference to us. How's that sound?
Yeah, that's good. I want to emphasize that, you know, we're, even though we were just talking a little bit negatively about some of the memoirs that are published nowadays, but there's, you know, there's certainly a lot of power, a great amount of power and value to be had in some of the memoirs that have been written in the past, or even currently. We're definitely not kind of dissing this entire genre, not by any stretch. So it's a good segue to talk about, you know, some of the memoirs we've read that have really made an impact on us. And there are some that I've read that, you know, whether a long time ago or recently, that, you know, I'm still thinking about quite a bit. They're going to live in my, you know, consciousness for quite some time. So, yeah, I think that sounds good. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back and start, you know, talking about a few of our personal favorites.
All right. That sounds good. We're taking a break. We'll be right back.
Okay. We're back after taking a quick break, and Jude, where are we going next?
So we're going to give some examples that we talked about, like three each, of memoirs that have been meaningful for us. I called it my essential list. I don't know if I would say essential, but like memoirs for us that have been examples of what we were talking about towards the end of the prior discussion. You know, just ones that did like a really effective job of translating that person's experience into something which is relatable by the rest of us. So I'm going to kick it to you. Why don't you talk about the first book that you wanted to point out to our listeners that did that for you?
Okay. Yeah. Like you were saying, it's like, I don't know if this is necessarily all time favorite, but it might just be, you know, ones we want to highlight or recommend. In a couple of cases, they are all time favorites of mine, but that we just think are particularly valuable or worth reading.
Right.
And I'm cheating a little bit, cause I'm going to call this the St. Augustine Memorial List. You know, because it's not one of my three, but really I have to mention the all-time world-famous book, Confessions by St. Augustine, which a lot of people would say is the first memoir ever, and probably not ever, but, you know, an ancient memoir that continues to be read to this day. And in that case, it's a spiritual memoir. He's literally telling the experience of his conversion from a very, very, very worldly young man to becoming, you know, a believer in Christ. And it's fascinating because, you know, that particular memoir, he wouldn't have called it that, but that's exactly what it is. He goes back and talks about, you know, a little bit about his upbringing and about his mother in particular, but then he just becomes like so many young people, like he just, you know, puts himself out there and just takes a full immersive dive into the world and experiences whatever he can. In every which way he can, you know, whether, you know, all the types of pleasures or experiences that he can pursue. But he tells a story of how he eventually, you know, is kind of pursued by the, you know, what Francis Thompson once called the Hound of Heaven, just won't let him go. Mm. And he eventually becomes, you know, one of the greatest saints in the history of Christianity. And he left us with this incredible book, you know, that kind of details his journey. But then it also goes well beyond just kind of his own experience and gets very philosophical and deep about time and memory and the nature of God and all kinds of things. But it's one of the greatest personal memoirs ever written. So we can't have this discussion without at least bringing it up once. But my first choice is sort of in that tradition, but it's a much, much, much more contemporary book. I think it was first written around 2011 or 12. And it's quickly, for me, I mentioned when I was a younger man, you know, I read a lot of spiritual memoirs, whether, you know, a lot of them are well known. Like I said, Surprised by Joy,
You mentioned Seven Story Mountain by Thomas Merton. You know, there are many others that I remember reading, but this one came out, you know, only in the last 10 years or so. It was written by a poet named Christian Wiman. And it's called My Bright Abyss, Meditation of a Modern Believer is what it's called. And you'll remember at least that title. I think you actually read the book too, on, I believe, on my recommendation. But
that's right.
This is a spiritual memoir. This is a spiritual story, but it's also a survival story. So Christian Wiman, very briefly, he's a poet. He's kind of around our age, maybe a little bit younger than us. But he is a published poet, actually ended up becoming editor of Poetry Magazine. So he jokes about that in the beginning of the book, how, like, that by definition, that makes his, you know, what he does, you know, appeals to only a very limited audience. And, you know, you're just not going to have a ton of cultural cachet if you're the editor of Poetry Magazine. You know, he acknowledges that that's kind of a niche market for sure. But he's successful in what he does. And he was raised in Texas by a Christian family, and he had sort of a spiritual experience growing up. So he's been, you know, pretty much his entire life, he's been a believer in Jesus in one way or another. But then just as he's getting married, he gets diagnosed with a very rare type of blood cancer that has no cure. And so he started writing articles and pieces about his experience, basically his faith experience in the light of having recently been married and then getting this, you know, having this diagnosis, and it eventually sort of coalesced into this memoir, which I think is just a remarkable spiritual meditation. It's one of the most powerful spiritual books that I've read in my whole adult life. And I reckon, you know, there's a lot about his style that appeals to me. You know, I love poetry. I love theology. I love the big questions. I love grappling with, you know, what does it mean to believe in God? How does that impact my daily life? How does that, you know, what does that mean for the daily problems you face as a human being walking the earth? You know, Christian Wiman writes in a very profound way about all these questions, but then he also weaves in, you know, questions, bigger questions of suffering and how, you know, how to handle essentially like a diagnosis like he has, and the knowledge that, you know, your life may be short, you know? And he sort of turns all this material into a really profound and elegantly written, you know, memoir of kind of grappling with God or with the divine or with all the big questions you may have while being faced with this kind of diagnosis. And I think it's just a remarkable book because of its bracing honesty, because of its clarity, and because of the way he kind of, in this case, this is an example of a memoir where he's, you know, describing a experience that's very specific to him, but he had me looking at my whole faith life, in a very, careful way. You know, I don't know exactly how to put it, but he really kind of grabbed me by the lapels and was like, really had me examining, you know, what do I really believe? What does it matter? How do my beliefs matter in my daily life? How are they going to matter when I'm faced with, you know, real adversity, the way that Christian Wiman did? I just think it's a very beautiful and very modern kind of grappling with the biggest questions that we have. And it's just beautifully written. Anybody who's interested in, you know, spiritual memoir or conversion stories, you can't miss this one for my money. But that's one that I know it doesn't appeal to everybody. If you're not a Christian believer, if you're not a Christian, certainly if you don't, you know, don't have a poetic sensibility, not that I do, but if you don't, I think it helps for you to appreciate kind of, what poets bring to the table. But nevertheless, I found this book to be really bracing, really thought-provoking, and moving. So that for me is one of the best memoirs I've read in a long time. I've read it about two or three times in the last 10 years because it just continues to kind of echo or resonate in my mind. So that's the first one for me.
Yeah, yeah, I've certainly heard you mention that book before, John. In fact, that's covered, or you spoke more about that book way back in episode 2 in the Books That Made Us Nonfiction, our second episode in this podcast series. So anybody who wants to hear more about that book can go check out that archival episode. But yeah,
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I went back and I listened to that one because I wanted to see if any of my nonfiction books that made me was a memoir, and they were not. That was one of the instructive exercises for me doing this. Because I was like, you know, the books that made me nonfiction, none of them are memoir.
Huh.
But, and also, John, it was interesting. I know that book, I read that book too. This just goes to show people what they already know, which is that nobody's the same reader, and even among identical twin brothers. I really struggled with that book. I thought that book was difficult, and I appreciated it very much for what it was, and the poetic way that it was written, and the levels of difficulty that this guy had gone through, both mentally. But I had trouble connecting with some of those struggles in that book. I wouldn't say I did not like the book. I appreciated it a lot. Didn't connect with it in the same way. And, you know, John, there was also some cancer experience in your lifetime that you were able to connect with what he was talking about that I lacked. And so there was different ways that you could sort of come at the book, you know, and obviously it was a book that was kind of came before you at the right place at the right time. Also, just poignantly, I remember you were very eager to share that with our dad when he was still alive and he read it. So I remember that too.
Yeah, and he also found it difficult. It's not easy to get on his wavelength, but I think it's a book that rewards, you know, sticking with it and, you know, careful reading and maybe coming back to again, because, you know, it's all subjective, but for me, I felt like he was tapping into some really rich veins in that book. Other people may not, you know.
Yeah, you can tell by the title. I mean, if that title speaks to you, that's one thing. And if that title makes you turn, you know, do an about face and run for, you know, an Uncle Stevie novel, you know, then. And speaking of Uncle Stevie, you know, I'm going to transition to one of my most essential or most recommended memoirs, I would have to say, from somebody, the perspective of somebody who writes fiction and nonfiction, is from Uncle Stevie. Stephen King is not a surprise, John, to anybody who listens to this show, and definitely not to you. But Stephen King wrote a memoir called On Writing in, I think, around 2000 maybe, when this book was published. Definitely one of my favorite memoirs. It was kind of cut into, I don't have to say a ton about it. A lot of people know about it. It was cut into kind of three sections. The first one was kind of autobiographical, talking about, but it was called, the subtitle is A Memoir of the Craft. So it was all relating back to what he has done for a living, better than or more successfully than anybody in the world, you know, practically, right. Maybe J.K. Rowling or Charles Dickens, but it was a memoir specific related to his writing life and his writing journey, you know, to become a writer. And obviously, I just drank that like a kitten with a bowl of milk. But the first section was about his childhood. You know, very famously, his father walked out on him when he was 2 years old, him and his mother and his baby brother. And he grew up without a father. And it just kind of journals his childhood and how he got into like horror and monsters and, you know, started down the pathway of becoming a writer. And then I kind of forget entirely what the second section is about. I think it just has more memoirish anecdotes from his, you know, life as a best-selling author. I don't remember, to be totally honest, but then the third section of the book recounts that famous accident he was involved in 1999, where he was walking down the road in Maine and somebody literally plowed over him with a van and brought him very right to the edge of death. And he writes about his painful recuperation, long recuperation, painkillers, physical therapy and stuff from this accident, and how he found his way back into becoming a writer and has thrived anew since then. I love this book. I love Stephen King's down-to-earth ways. He's like the most famous writer on the planet. He's a, like a supremely wealthy man. Everybody knows Stephen King. He still somehow manages to be a regular human being who wears jeans and like AC/DC t-shirts, you know.
Goes to baseball games.
Exactly. You know, and he has an unbelievably prolific imagination. He just keeps outputting story after story with such crazy imaginative elements. Not all of them work at all, but he just has an incredible imagination. But maybe my favorite thing about this book is that at the time that it came out, you know, he was one or two years away from, he was eventually, this was before that, but he was eventually awarded a very prestigious medal for his contributions to American literature. And he gave a very famous speech. Again, this is a couple years after he wrote this book. But it was around that period of time, around the millennium and the dawn of the 21st century, when there this kind of sub-debate in the literary culture rose of whether he was worthwhile of being considered like a guy who could get an award like that or even write a memoir about writing because of his like pulpy catalog. And for me, the best thing about this book was to how he kind of went at that head on, not in an arrogant way, but he kind of had this way of explaining the book. He was like, listen, you know, I don't remember how he put it. I recommend readers read it. Anybody who's interested in writing and creativity should read On Writing by Stephen King. But at one point in the book, he's just like, listen, I don't know how else to say this. I've sold 600 million books around the entire globe. You know, I've written something like 70 novels and like 400 short stories. I know how to do this. So if you want, he's like, if you want to know something about how I got there and some of the insights that I have, then pull up a chair and be my guest. If you don't think that I can have anything to say about it, you know, there's the door.
Right. You know?
And I love that about him. I mean, to think that a guy of his level of success would have nothing to say or is not worth listening to on the craft of writing is such bull crap. You know, that I don't know what else to say about it. Anyway, as somebody who aspires to read as many books as I can and write as many books as I can, this was an essential memoir for me. I loved it. I've read it twice, and I would read it again happily tomorrow. I think you've read it. Do you have anything to say about it?
Yeah, I read it, and it would have been on my list too, probably, if I hadn't known that it was definitely without any doubt at all going to be on your list. Right. But it's such a great book. It's one of the great things. Like, here's a memoir that has, like you said, if you have any interest in fiction or writing at all, it has real utility, has real value. But it's also, it's just fun. It's a fun, but he manages to keep it fun too. You know, I remember like
all his books,
but in the very beginning, he's like, in the first sentence says something like, you know, like back in like 1996 or seven, when I was on stage with my, you know, part-time garage band, I can't remember what they're called, the Broken Down Radiators or something, or do you remember?
yeah, something like that. I don't even remember.
It's like him and a couple other writers, and he's like, back in that time, you know, there was a time when I was on stage with, what's his name, Dave Barry and something else. He's like, and he says, it maybe 1996 or 97. It's hard to remember when you're having a good time. You know, this is the first line of the book, you know. And it's just, I remember thinking, you know, this book's going to be a lot of fun. And I guess the point I'm making is like, he manages to write what I think is a really fun and interesting memoir, but there's zero pretentiousness as well. You know, like, the Christian Wyman book, which I just mentioned, which is a book that I love. A lot of people, they'd be out in the first two, three pages, right? Because it's just, it's not highfalutin. It's just, the guy's a poet. So he's, you know, he uses, you know, pretty language. He uses heavy concepts, and he really, you know, digs deep into that kind of stuff. And that really appeals to me. But the Stephen King book, it's just, it's a great book, but it's just like hanging out with a guy who plays rock and roll. You know what I mean? You still there? Well, I don't know what happened.
You still there?
I'm here.
John?
Yes?
Yeah. All right. All right, John. I think we had a little audio difficulty, but why don't we move on to your second book I talked about, On Writing. What's your second memoir you want to talk about?
Yeah, I was making some comments there about On Writing, and I can't tell right now whether they came through or not, so if you heard them, great. If not, no big deal. My second one is kind of an old school pick, dude. I'm not even sure I told you that I was going to pick this one, but I was thinking of a lot of memoirs that I've read. But I wanted to give a shout out to this one. Again, I don't know if this is in my absolute, you know, favorite books I've ever read, but I think it's a really worthwhile memoir, and people are still reading it, and I think it has real value. And it's a book by George Orwell called Down and Out in Paris and London. And I remember reading it, you know, several years back. So I don't remember a ton of detail from it. Have you read that book, Dino?
No, I have not.
Okay. It's really good. And the reason why I think it's worth highlighting here is that, you know, he's one of the first, you know, journalists to really pay attention to, like, people who are just scraping to get by in a major urban area. You know, he wrote another book about poor people who were working in the mines in England called The Road to Wigan Pier, which I have not read. But George Orwell, you know, whether you agreed with all his political views or not, he was a real sort of champion of the working man in an authentic way. You know, we joke about Bruce Springsteen is sort of seen that way nowadays. I'm not so sure, you know, sometimes he had sort of had that reputation, but, you know, he definitely, he has a 1% life, let's put it that way. And maybe George Orwell did too, but George Orwell wrote an entire book, Down and Out in Paris and London, in which he went to those two cities, and he basically went without a job, and he just recounts his experience kind of like working in very, you know, menial jobs and trying to scrape by with absolutely no money at all, and kind of describing the people he was hanging out with, and basically poor folks in an urban setting, you know, people who are homeless, people who are living in shelters. And he describes a whole series of jobs that he has in both cities, like washing dishes, or like at one point he becomes kind of a messenger for somebody, and he gets involved with, you know, smuggling drugs to somebody else. And he just kind of lives in the underworld, you know, in these two cities. And he writes this, you know, and this is when he was a young man. He was only in his 20s when he did this, so it's one of his earliest books. But it's a really kind of vivid account of, you know, somebody who's just trying to scrape by, you know, trying to establish themselves in a city. And when you think about it, like, there are so many people in that position now, whether it's New York, LA, you know, whether there are people who have emigrated to this country and are trying to build a life for themselves, or maybe people who moved to one of those cities to try to, like, pursue a dream or whatever. So many people end up just kind of like working, like, in the restaurant industry, working in the service industry, working as maids or cleaners or cooks, you know? And like, George Orwell is one of the first people to kind of write a book about that experience. And it's just, you know, populated with all these colorful characters who are just kind of scraping by. It's a little bit like the famous Barbara, Eichenreich or Aaron Reich. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. Her book, Nickeled and Dimed, On Not Getting By in America, mm-hmm. which is another book I read and kind of considered for this list. But that's, I think that's more of a kind of like, you know, reportage, you know, kind of like reporting on a specific subject. And Orwell is just kind of, it's sort of like half travel memoir, half like personal memoir, but it's just a really vivid account of being poor in an urban area and kind of scraping to get by. And it just, like I said, it just has all these, you know, hilarious and strange characters who live in the underbelly of these two cities. And along the way, he sort of describes, you know, the differences, what it's like to live in Paris versus London. And it's just really a cool is not the right word, but it's just sort of a fascinating account. And I think it's worth, you know, mentioning just because, again, he's one of the earliest writers, at least in the 20th century, who really, you know, paid attention to people who are just working so easy to forget people who work, you know, sort of behind the scenes and kind of do the menial tasks that most of society doesn't want to do. But this is a really colorful and vivid book about that experience. And it's always stayed with me. So that was my second choice.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, and then, again, it sort of blurs the lines because, like, how was that book not reportage if Barbara Eichenreich's book was reportage? And it sounds like it was some form of reportage, but anyway, at the same time, it was a segment of Orwell's life that he decided to focus on in a nonfiction book, and he wrote it in a compelling way. So, and what you said there at the end is what makes a difference. It kind of stayed in your mind, you know, amongst all the dross of other things you've read before. You know?
Yeah, and I think the other thing, it is a fine line. I think Barbara Eichenreich, I think I'm murdering that name, but she, you know, kind of stepped out of her regular life and almost disguised herself as a worker at like Walmart and other stores like that, just to see, just, or a waitress, just to, and it was part of like a journalistic project. She was writing a series of articles, whereas Orwell, like, he was sort of living his life. He's just recounting a part of his life where he was trying to make it in these cities. And then he went back later and wrote a book about it, you know, or published his memories of it, you know. So, but anyway, It's just when I was thinking about the subject of memoir, you know, there's so many directions you can go with it, right? And we didn't quite talk about this, so I'll just mention it briefly. But there's like, you know, there's the childhood memoir, you know, I survived this type of childhood. Or there's a memoir of illness. Or there's a memoir of surviving some kind of disastrous event. Like somebody I happen to know personally who went missing for 18 days in the jungle, you know? And yeah. I don't think she's written a memoir of this person, but, you know, that's the kind of, you know, people go through this incredibly traumatic event and then they publish a book about it, you know? So Stephen King, a memoir about doing a specific type of job and how you do it. So there are all these different types of memoirs, but, you know, I thought it would be important to include one that's about, you know, both the experience of being, you know, economically deprived and also of working. So that's why I put it in my list.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to you.
It's by the way, it's Ehrenreich. Ehrenreich.
Ehrenreich. I knew I was getting something wrong, but thank you.
And just go back earlier, you were right on the author of The Glass Castle, Jeanette Walls was her name. You know, that intern over here is really, you know, making up some time.
Yeah, finally earning their pay, which is nothing. So
anyway, all right. Well, the next one for me, I'm going to talk about only briefly because I've mentioned it a couple of other times. And in particular, this one came up in our episode on music. I think it's like episode 33 and a third, I believe we called it, on music.
Yep.
Favorite books about music. I talked at length about this book in that episode. So the book is called Chronicles, Volume 1, and it was written by Mr. Bob Dylan, who, you know, if you want some writing credentials, he went on to win the Nobel Prize in Literature.
That's right.
Later, you know, the only American songwriter who's, like, done that. But anyway, he wrote, I would consider it a memoir. You know, first of all, it's called Volume 1. It came out in 2004, but in the most Bob Dylan manner possible. Like, in ever since then, there's been no Volume 2, you know?
Yeah.
And also, in a very Bob Dylan way, it was a music memoir, talked about him and his journey, how he became a musician, you know, the way that he made records, etc. But it's not a very long memoir. It's like maybe 300 pages long. And it jumps around in time quite a bit. It's in five sections. It talks about two, like, very random records from his extensive catalog and how he made those records. One of them was called New Morning in the 70s, and the other one is called Oh Mercy, which he made in New Orleans with Daniel Lanois, the guy that produced the Joshua Tree and, you know, lots of other records. So it talks about the making of those records, but at the very beginning of the memoir, it describes his life before he made it big. And it literally starts with him getting dropped off by a taxi in Greenwich Village, having come from, like, Ebbings, Minnesota, or whatever the town is in Minnesota,
right,
that Robert Zimmerman came from. He's getting dropped off in New York City, and he's suddenly, he's like, Bob Dylan, and he touches a little bit about where he got the name Bob Dylan from. It's a totally fascinating book. It's all driven by his famous songwriting style and his lyrics, which are known to be enigmatic, kind of erudite, obtuse, you know, like a, that, you know, you can interpret it in a thousand ways. His prose style is very much the same thing. Like, he jumps around from episode to episode. He writes these long, rambling paragraphs that has some really incredible lines in them and beautiful images, but you, what they add up to, anybody's guess. And I'll never forget in that book, there's a description, a very vivid description. He's talking about being at somebody's party in Greenwich Village in the very early 60s before he had made it big. He's looking around the room and he kind of just disappears into the fabric of the wall or whatever. You know, again, very Bob Dylan, and he's just describing the other people in the room, and it's this gaggle of, like, weirdos, you know, like, there's somebody in, like, you know, like, a cat suit. There's like, what he famously describes, like, a tugboat captain who's there with, like, the pipe and the hat, and he's telling stories about the sea, you know, like, and again, somebody else is wearing, like, you know, in full drag, you know, like, having, like, a joint with a priest or something like that, you know. And he's just, it's going around the room, and you have no idea if what is being described is actually something he saw, or if it's just figments of his imagination, or if it's him in some way making figures that are representative of his adventures. Like, you have no idea, and he doesn't tell you. You know?
Right, right.
And the whole book is like that, just like his music. I read it twice. I thought it was utterly fascinating both times. Nobody else would have written a book like this. And if you have any interest in either Bob Dylan or the creative mind behind one of the most legendary musical figures in the history of popular music, you should read Chronicles Volume 1.
Right. I was going to bring this up before because we talked a little bit about how sometimes what separates a memoir from other memoirs is just the way it's written. Mm-hmm. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
And I was going to bring that up as an example, because that's just like, he has just such an inimitable style. There's only one Bob Dylan, period, you know, full stop. And just right. Reading his memoir, you know, his life story is interesting, obviously. And he's this legendary songwriter and singer and figure in our culture. So that has interest too, but it's more just like the way he expresses things, you know, like you read that book almost just to, because it's written in the voice of Bob Dylan, and there is no one else has a voice anything like that, you know. So
yeah, like you don't know if it's just some strange fever dream somewhere between fiction and nonfiction. Who knows? Like, you know, like he's not saying, and you know, like
right,
that's just a totally unique American voice. It's a great book. It's great reading. You know, people should take it on. But anyway, let's keep going. What's your third one?
Well, my third one is, like you said, you read a kind of contemporary memoir just to kind of sample something that's, you know, been popular in the last year or so. And I did the same thing. I read a book that was a bestseller maybe a couple of years ago. But, you know, it was made quite a splash when it was published. And with good reason. And it's a book, and I didn't do this on purpose. It just so happens that I chose two memoirs that both involve people who are fighting cancer. So that was not intentional. I mean, as I mentioned before, there's all kinds of memoirs, and, you know, some are a lot more fun, like On Writing. But this book, I was just curious about it because it has such a great reputation, and it really seemed to, like, strike a nerve with a lot of people. And it was written by a neurosurgeon named Dr. Paul Kalanithi, if I'm saying that right. And it's a book called When Breath Becomes Air. And it's basically a chronicle of, like, the last year of his life. And it's amazingly written, but it's a book about, you know, kind of what happened is he trained for like literally 10 years to achieve his dream of becoming a neurosurgeon, which is, and he kind of describes all the training and all the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into trying to achieve, you know, become a doctor, but not just a doctor, like kind of an elite neurosurgeon. And, you know, not many people can do that, but it's literally a 10 year journey to get there. And then he's literally just about to finish it. And he's newly married and, you know, thinking of starting a family, but he gets through this 10 years and he gets this stage 4 lung cancer diagnosis. And he really has to grapple with, I mean, it says this in the Jackie copy, but it's just sort of like, what happens when you've been, you know, kind of focused for your whole life in a way, or for many, many years of your life towards a specific goal, and then you learn you're never going to reach that goal. What meaning does your life have at that point? And like he just, which is a really interesting question, but so he's not only throughout the book, he's bravely facing the fact that he knows he's going to die, but he's also facing these very difficult questions. Okay. What was the good of my life? What meaning does my life have? You could say, well, I have a young daughter and I'm a family man, but I'm not going to be there for my family. Or I learned how to do incredibly intricate and life-saving brain surgeries, but I'm not going to be able to do those surgeries because I'm not going to survive this disease. And he didn't, you know, what meaning does my life have? And he really kind of dives deeply into that. And so this is a memoir that is really moving because it's on one level, it's just somebody who's just kind of grappling with this awful diagnosis and the fact that he just had a baby daughter and, you know, he died when his daughter was 8 months old. So, you know, just the idea that he's leaving this book behind is poignant. It's
poignant.
On that level. Also, just these, he kind of just really beautifully and movingly writes about, like, what is the purpose of medicine? And, you know, when you strive to become a doctor, what are you actually doing? How can you really help your patients? And then he also, in his background, he studied literature. So he kind of weaves that into it too. And it's kind of this meditation on, you know, mortality and and the meaning of death and how that impacts your life, you know, how you can really have a meaningful life, even though you're staring at death. And it's really beautifully written. I wanted to give you, I told you, Jude, that he, studied literature as part of his background. So he's got this medical background and he's also got this literary background, which it won't surprise you to learn, you know, the memoir is beautifully written, but just to give you kind of a sample of the way he writes, there's this little passage about literature that I thought was really interesting and would resonate with you and kind of a little bit what this podcast is all about. So he makes this side comment. He says, literature, and this is coming from a man of science who's a doctor, you know, so I thought this was really interesting. Literature not only illuminated another's experience, it provided, I believe, the richest material for moral reflection. My brief forays into the formal ethics of analytic philosophy felt dry as a bone, missing the messiness and weight of real human life. So that's him talking about, you know, what literature does. And I thought it just gives you a sample of how, you know, kind of clear and beautiful his writing can be, but how human as well. I thought this was a very moving book. You know, he was writing it literally right up to when he died, and he asked, one of his literal dying wishes was, he asked his wife and his family to make sure that the book got published. And so, you know, when you read the book, you know, you're literally reading, you know, kind of his last thoughts as he passes on, you know. And it's just a really powerful and beautiful reflection on mortality and on what makes life meaningful. And, you know, it's not overtly religious, although he does talk about how eventually he had to grapple with, you know, what he believed about the divine and, you know, the answers to the biggest questions. But nonetheless, it's just a really beautifully expressed book, and I found it very, very moving. So it's one that I would highly recommend in terms of being a contemporary memoir.
Yeah. I mean, I remember hearing about that book. I remember you saying that you were checking it out. That observation he made about simple observation, but like kind of a profound one about, you know, what the value, I guess, of literature, you know, to help you kind of like suss out moral insights from, you know, being here was like interesting, you know, and that's an example of like somebody who, that's an example of a memoir of somebody who kind of, you know, due to their own misfortune and, you know, suffering, had really had something to say and found a way to say it. That story about him urging his family to publish a book reminds me of that famous anecdote about Marcel Proust kind of pushing around the pages of the last volume of In Search of Lost Time on his bed, you know, when he was like, you know, on the way out the door.
Right. You know, like, right.
You know, somebody who was really, and that in itself is just an extreme, I guess it's like the, you know, quite an indication of somebody who really had something they wanted to say while they were here, you know. Anyway.
Indeed.
Great choice. And then for me, my last one is actually two, breaking the rules here. It's a tie. I couldn't think of, I kind of really struggled to think of a third one. Then I realized that these two books I'm going to bring up, the first two books I brought up, On Writing and Chronicles Volume 1, are very well known. These two are very obscure. One a little bit less so, but they're pretty obscure. They're from other countries. I realized that these are two memoirs that really stayed with me that not many people might know about. And I read one of them twice. The second one I haven't read twice, but they're about, this is really high in the empathy department, people in other parts of the world who went through things that I couldn't even begin to imagine. So I'll just bring up both of them. The first one is, there is a kind of a classic, at least in this country, the country of its origin, which is Ireland. There's a classic memoir written by somebody who became best known as a poet and kind of a memoirist by the name of Brendan Behan. And it's a book some people might have heard of, a memoir that's entitled Borstal Boy. And it's a very regional book. You have to sort of know something about Ireland and England and the United Kingdom to even know what that title means. But Borstal is basically a reform school. And it's a famous novel or memoir that Behan wrote about how he was incarcerated at the age of 16 he's from Northern Ireland. But he goes over to Liverpool as a young teenager, and he gets arrested for kind of trucking with the IRA. He's arrested as an agitator, whatever that means. And because he's so young, he gets sent to this English reform school in like the country, the West Country of England, which is called a Borstal. And the rest of the memoir is simply his account of trying to make his way through basically prison life and extremely impoverished conditions, being watched by people that they called screws, prison guards, a word you come across in sort of like Irish Republican literature from time to time. And it's a memoir of him trying to survive that experience as a minor. So he was only going to stay there for a limited time, but he basically grows up the rest of the way in this reform school. And it's just a very vividly written, memorable, funny memoir about living that experience. And it's written in this crazy Irish / English stew, you know, like a lot of the swear words are misspelled deliberately, like F-U-G-H-I-N, you know, for the F word. And just like, you know, it's just like sort of the language is all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's about him making friendships and trying to survive that experience. And I would really recommend it for its lyrical writing and for its, it catches you by the heart in a lot of different places. It brings up some of his, you know, regrets for missing out on his mother, missing his mother and his sisters and his family. And then at the very end of the book, there's a really memorable scene. I don't want to give it away completely, but he kind of gets out and he crosses the sea and he gets to immigration, and the guy at immigration who's processing him back into Ireland, gives him a once over, and he recognizes him as somebody from his country. You know, he sees in him, and he asks him in Gaelic kind of what he's been up to. And he says he's returning from the, from serving time in the borstal. And then the immigration man takes his hand and gives him a welcome in Gaelic. And, well, I'll just give away this last line again. And he says, like, in Gaelic, he says, "It must be wonderful to be free." And Brendan Behan in reply says, "It must be." And then he walks down, like, the gangway on the boat back into Ireland. You know, and it's just a really poignant and interesting memoir about this guy kind of recognizing him from afar, this immigration official speaking to him in Gaelic and saying, "Welcome back to Ireland," you know. And it's a really good book. So cool. That's cool. Borstal Boy by Brendan Behan. And then the other book is totally different. It's a book called Red Dust. The subtitle is A Path Through China. And it's written by a guy who's best known as a novelist. I think he's still alive. But he was like a dissident artist. He was also a painter, like a guy who kind of spent most of his life running afoul of the Chinese authorities, the communist Chinese government, and protesting and doing, creating works of art in protest to the Chinese government. And what's really interesting about this book is kind of the setup. He is involved with these dissident activities in, I forget the city, but one of the major cities in China, and he gets arrested by the Chinese government on the charges of spiritual pollution. He's arrested and incarcerated for the crime of spiritual pollution because of his artistic endeavors. He either escapes or he gets out somehow, and he decides that he's going to flee the city and wander China on foot to the most remotest regions of China on foot. And it takes him 3 years to do it. And he goes from villages, from town to town, the mountains and the valleys and the rivers and all that stuff through the full landscape of China, and ends up back in the city at the end. And it's this, some people would describe it as a Chinese version of On the Road by Kerouac, but it has none of the, you know, joie de vivre. Or like, crazy, you know, mad, sad angels or whatever, like of the Beat books. It's just this chronicle, kind of a moving chronicle of this kind of sort of lost individual eking his way across China through the harshest conditions imaginable and living with the people that he finds from town to town. So that's Red Dust. That's a really obscure book, but it's really worth reading if people can find it. And those are my last selections.
Damn, that sounds really fascinating, that book in particular.
Yeah, it is.
Well, before we wrap up, I wanted to, like, there's so many memoirs from, you know, all the different types that we mentioned. There's so many, you know, as wide as the variety of human experience, you know. But there are a few that I've always wanted to read. I haven't read, but I thought I would just mention them if you don't mind, because, you know, most of them are pretty well known, but I think they would be really interesting. They're on my list to take on one day, so I'll just kind of run through them really quick.
Okay.
Yeah, the first one is called Kitchen Confidential, and it was famously the first book written by Anthony Bourdain, kind of a very, very famous chef who's unfortunately passed away now, but he wrote this book. I think it's subtitled Adventures in the Culinary Underbelly. And he wrote this book about what it's like to work in the kitchens of some of the most, you know, high-end and famous restaurants in New York City, I believe. I think it's New York City. It might be more than one city. I'm not sure because I haven't read it. But, you know, it's just something totally different than the other ones that I picked out. And that's the beauty of, you know, reading memoirs, they can immerse you in a world that's totally foreign to your own. I just think, you know, and this is a very famous book. It kind of really made a splash and kind of exposed a lot of people to elements of the culinary world that they just knew nothing about. It kind of made Anthony Bourdain into a star, you know, and he eventually became quite a TV star. Had a couple very well, you know, widely popular series about food and
which I've never actually seen. I've never seen any of his series. I'd really like to, because they're supposed to be pretty good. Anyway, he seems like a really interesting individual, and Kitchen Confidential is a book that I've wanted to read for years, but never have. So that's another one that I think sounds really well worth taking on.
Yeah. And John.
Yeah.
You know, you remember he's no longer with us, right?
Yeah, I said that, didn't I? I said it.
Oh, did you say it?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought I missed that.
Sorry. Yeah, he passed away, unfortunately, a couple years back. But the next one really quick is, this one's an older one, but it's well known. It was made into a film. It's a book I've always been curious about reading, and it probably, in some ways, I'm sure it doesn't age very well, but I would still love to read it. It's called Out of Africa, and it was written by, well, the pen name is Isaac Dinesen, but her real name was Karen Blixen. I've read a few of her books of short stories. She's a really great writer. This is probably her best known book, and it's about, it's just kind of a, like a memoir about work, setting up and working on a farm. I believe it's in Kenya, but I'm not 100% sure. But it's a very famous book. I think it would be interesting to read about, you know, people trying to run a farm in Kenya. Now, I say it probably doesn't age well because, you know, of the idea of, like, you know, white colonials essentially setting up shop in an African country and kind of, you know, just taking the, working the land that they want. You know, I think there's, you know, aspects of that that are maybe uncomfortable, but it's still a very well-known book. I think it would probably be really interesting to read. And I know that Isaac Dinesen, to use her pen name, is a really, really capable writer. That's a book I'd love to read sometime. You never read that, have you?
No, I did read it.
Yep. Oh, did you? Okay. I don't.
Yeah, I read it 4 or 5 years ago.
I won't put you on the spot, but I don't know if you remember it. But it's always seemed to me like it would be a really interesting book to read. So I hope to get to it someday.
Yeah.
Next one I have is, I have two more really quick. The next one I have is also made into a film. I've actually seen the film. But the story is just too incredible. Like, I would like to go back and read this memoir one day because of the extraordinary circumstances around its production, you know. And that's called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. That was written by a Frenchman. I'm trying to remember his name. I think I might have it written down here somewhere. I want to, you know, give the proper attribution here. Sorry. Dominique Bobby is the name of the author. But I don't know if you're probably familiar with that title, but I remember seeing the film. But basically, this is somebody who got into a really bad accident and was totally paralyzed and ended up, the only muscle in his entire body that he could move was his left eyelid. And somehow he ended up, you know, being able to communicate with somebody using only his left eyelid, and they come up with a whole language. And he wrote an entire memoir through that, you know, using that mechanism, which is just absolutely incredible. And it's just sort of like, I've always been fascinated by that, but because here's another example of, like, someone who's faced with these just unthinkable personal circumstances and kind of finding meaning out of their life when almost everything that this person had been taken from them. And, you know, there's no way that book isn't interesting. So that's always been one I've been curious about. And then the last one, I should have the person's name written down. Let me see if I have the author's name here, but this one is a book. It's very, very contemporary, you know, just came out in the last year or so. And I'm really curious about it. And it's called, the book is called Solito, a memoir. And the author is Javier Zamora. Have you ever heard of this book?
No, I have not.
Well, the reason it's basically, you know, and this is something that we talked about recently, you know, personally, not as part of the podcast, but it's a firsthand account of immigrating from El Salvador and making that crossing all the way through some of the Central American countries like Guatemala and up through Mexico into the United States. And it just kind of recounts that whole journey. And it's a really
It's a very acclaimed book. It just came out in the last year or so, or even in the last couple of months. And it just sounds like a fascinating, you know, like I think there's, you talk about empathy, but just being able to see, you know, what is it actually like, you know, to try to walk on foot and basically, you know, journey from El Salvador to the United States. This book, as a 9-year-old, by the way, this book kind of describes that. And I think it sounds like it's just utterly fascinating. And he just kind of takes you step by step through that whole journey. And I just can't even imagine what that would be like. So, you know, I'd really like to read that. I think that sounds fascinating. And it would certainly be eye-opening, you know, for people in the United States to read. So.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, very timely.
That's right. So that's that. And, you know, just a full disclosure, you know, this is kind of on my long list as an exchange selection to give to you, because I just thought it sounded really interesting. But then I kind of thought, you know, it might be a little bit more up my alley than yours. But it's that kind of book, you know, it's just kind of like catches your eye and you go, man, this sounds like it could be really, really interesting. So I would love to read that one someday.
It couldn't possibly not be fascinating, you know.
And there's no way, you know, to just kind of like actually see what that journey would be like. You know, we hear about it a lot, but to actually kind of like walk alongside somebody who's doing it, you know, I can't even imagine.
No, I can't either. Most, you know, born in Americans can't.
That's right. So.
Well, great job. I think we did as best we could to unpack that massive topic, you know, and hopefully the listeners got some good ideas for memoirs that they could check out. You know, if you are listening and you have more and you want to let us know, send us an email, tell us. But that wraps up our discussion on memoirs. And now, John, we'll talk really quick about what we're going to be reading next, and then we'll at least ring in on episode 61. So I guess I'll go first, and then do you want to take care of, like, just sort of teasing whatever's coming up next?
Sure.
Okay. So I have mentioned many times, I'm still trying to get through this horror anthology called The Dark Descent. Not there yet. So for those of you who are waiting to find out if I conquered that one, you got to keep waiting. Sorry. I'm finishing up the memoir Stay True by Watt Shu, and I'm going to be done with that soon. And then I think I mentioned, like on the last episode, next up for me is a reread of a famous novel called The Plague. It was written by Albert Camus, who was a Nobel Prize in Literature recipient. I'm writing it because of it plays in a little bit to this novel that I am working on. But I also remember reading the book, you know, in the mid-2000s. I was very impressed with it. I haven't read a lot of Camus. I want to read this specific novel again rather than another one for a reason related to my story that I'm working on. But I don't remember the book. I just remember being so impressed with Albert Camus' writing that I just imagine it's going to be a quick and very rewarding experience to reread The Plague. So that's what's coming up next for me. And why don't you share what you're going to read next, and then wrap us up, if you don't mind.
That's a great one. I love Albert Camus. As you know, I think I mentioned on the show before that The Plague is one that I reread during the, a number of people did. I reread it during the whole COVID pandemic. Just thought it would be kind of timely, but it's a really powerful book. And, so that's some good stuff that you have on your table. The next book for me that I have coming up.
And, of course, John, sorry to interrupt. Of course, Albert Camus is also our birthday buddy.
That's right.
We're on the same day as us, so we're just saying.
Important to mention.
Yep.
So there's a writer named David Grann who writes, like, really riveting nonfiction. He's kind of very much in the public eye these days because he wrote a book called Killers of the Flower Moon, which is about to come out as a major film directed by Martin Scorsese. Can't wait to see it. That book was absolutely riveting. I brought it up on this. It's come up on this show a couple times. And I've read a couple books by David Grann, but he has a previous book
That's a collection of like different essays and articles that he had written on a variety of topics. I'm reading a novel now, so I like to swing, as listeners know, I like to swing kind of back and forth between fiction and nonfiction. So this is just a collection of some of his articles that he's written over the years. It's called The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession by David Grand. So, you know, being a fan of his work, I know that this book contains a long article that has been on my radar for a long time, but I've never read it. I can't remember where it was initially published. Might have been something like National Geographic or maybe even The New Yorker. I don't remember, but it was about people who were, and this is going back several years now, but it was about the scientists who were obsessed with finding a living specimen of the giant squid, because they were, you know, giant squid have been known to be around for a long, long time, but up until very recently, no one had ever captured one on film or actually seen one. They've been seen now, but literally, I think it was in like 2012 or something was the first time anybody ever captured a giant squid on video, which is incredible. But anyway, one of the pieces is about, you know, the pursuit of the giant squid, which that kind of thing, just like I'm in just from that description. So I love reading books of essays and you know, reportage. And I think this, you know, I know David Grand is a really kind of a gripping writer. So this is going to be a lot of fun to read. I'm really looking forward to that one.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be awesome.
So, yeah, that's what I'm reading next. And then just to wrap things up, this will be quick because as you and I, we haven't quite decided yet what episode number 61 is going to be. So I hope, you know, I hope that's not a letdown, but we'll be announcing it pretty soon once we kind of figure out what we want to do. We have some ideas for future episodes, but we really just we're not able to kind of get together and nail down exactly what we're going to do for the next one after this one. So that announcement will be forthcoming soon. There will be an episode 61. Don't worry, as long as we can keep this app working. And so stay tuned for that. I think that kind of brings us to the end.
Yep, it does. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Another great episode, John. Yeah, we'll be getting back to everybody with the next episode 61. But until then, thank you for listening to the Book Exchange Podcast. Take care.
All right. Take it easy, Jude. And thanks again to our listeners.
Bye-bye.